Welcome to this podcast from Harvest Community Church of Huntersville, North Carolina, where our vision is to make disciples who make disciples. I'm your host, Meg Robinson. On today's podcast, we hear a message from the preaching series on Genesis called Beginnings. This sermon introduces us to an obscure but important figure, Melchizedek. Let's listen in to Senior Pastor Jerry Barber's message from Genesis 14, 1 through 24, an early picture of Christ.
Now, if you travel to Arizona, you might see this sign, or a sign that looks like this, Grand Canyon National Park. And if you keep going past that sign, you might be in for one of the greatest experiences of your life, and you might actually get into the Grand Canyon. Now, there's a difference between the sign that points us to an awesome reality and the reality itself. Now, that will come to play later in the sermon. You'll see what that has to do with our passage today. Now, we're going to look at Genesis 14 today, but before we look at Genesis 14, I want us to start with two verses out of the New Testament. Hebrews chapter 6, verse 19 to 20. We've already had some of Hebrews read to us this morning, but this is speaking about the hope that God gives through Jesus Christ. And verse 19 says, "We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. It enters the inner sanctuary behind the curtain where our forerunner, Jesus, has entered on our behalf. He has become a high priest forever in the order of Melchizedek." Now, who is Melchizedek? And what does it mean that Jesus is a priest in the same order of Melchizedek? And how does that affect our lives today? Those are the questions that this sermon is going to address. The very first place that Melchizedek is mentioned in the Bible is Genesis chapter 14. And I want to invite your attention there. And that's perfect for us because here at Harvest, we're doing a series in Genesis through the book of Genesis called Beginnings. And today we come to Genesis 14. Now the events of Genesis 14 happened approximately 2000 BC. I'm going to put some timelines as we look at an early picture of Christ. We're going to give you some pictures and some general timelines. The setting of this story in Genesis 14, Abram has kind of been our key character for a few weeks here. He and his wife had been down to Egypt with his nephew Lot. They had some bad experiences there. Now they come back into the land of Canaan. And when they come back into the land of Canaan, they both are fairly wealthy and they've got a lot of flocks and herds, and so the land will not support all of them living right there together. So Abram says to Lot, "Lot, look around, take what you want. Wherever you want to go, you can go and you can have, and we'll go the other direction." And Lot chooses the well-watered plains, but actually moving east towards the very edge of what was known as the land of Canaan, near two cities out there, two little towns, Sodom and Gomorrah. And at first, Lot was just moving out towards that area. All of that has set us up now to come to Genesis 14 because there are other people that live around. It's not just Abram and his crew and Lot and his crew. There are a bunch of other people that live in these places. And we're going to meet some of them today, and we're going to find out what's happening in Genesis 14. Now, so all of you that are helping have a name tag there. First of all, Mike, would you take that mic stand and move it over? And Nick, would you take that one and just move it just kind of out of the way? So I want you guys to kind of take your places here. So let's start out. Nick, if you'll go stand over by the mic stand, kind of hold up. This is who you represent. I want you to hold your sheet up. Okay. And Barb, if you will go there and stand kind of near the 318 over there. Now, let's get all of the blue kings except for you. You just hang right there. Well, you just kind of go hang over there somewhere, and you three come up here together on the steps. Don't hurt yourself, but you're kind of together because you're a coalition. All right, now I need the you just stay right there. You're good right there. Are you okay with that? You're not getting on the stage? Okay. All right, good. So let's get all the green kings to kind of take your places here on the step, just kind of in these areas, however you want to arrange yourself. That'll be good. And let's see, who are you? Okay. I think, Mike, you should come over here, maybe up on the top step. And Paula, if you'll just kind of be on the second step there. So I want to give you a sense. Who are you? What are you? Oh, okay. Yeah, Amraphel. Okay. I want to give you a sense of what's happening, because this is a very confusing story if you just read it through, honestly. There's a lot going on here, so we're going to let you see what is going on here. The first 10 verses of this chapter describe a war that's happening between two different coalitions of kings in the area. There's a coalition right here of these three kings, and actually there's four, Amraphel, but he's not in the picture quite yet, but it's three of them with Chedorlaomer, okay, or Chedorlaomer. Let's just call him King K for short, okay? King K is kind of the chief king in this area, and there is going to be some fighting, some battle going on between these five kings right here. Now, these two particular kings, we've put the place where they are. Bera is the king of Sodom, and Birsha is the king of Gomorrah. We've got the other kings. Zoar is actually not the king's name, if you read the story. Zoar is just the place. They don't name the king name. So, Lizzie, we don't know your name. We just know you're a king, okay? All right. So now, these guys are going to be fighting against these guys. And the reason why is for all of the years, for 12 years, all of these people paid taxes and tribute to King K. They did it for 12 years. And you know what? How many of you like to pay taxes? All right. Nobody likes to pay taxes. Nobody likes to pay tribute. And so after 12 years, they said, you know what? We aren't doing that anymore. We aren't going to pay taxes. Now, King K and his associates got together and said, what should we do about this? They said, here's what we'll do about them. We'll go attack them. All right, so I want you guys to go attack these guys. Just kind of act it out just a little bit. You're attacking. All right, and you're fighting. In fact, you see, come on over and, I mean, don't just get close like you're fighting. You can hold that pose. That's a good pose. The four kings, now watch what happened. Verse 11, the four kings seized all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food, and they went away. You see, there's four now because they've brought in the other one. So Amraphel, you come in here. So it starts with three against five, and the three are winning, and they start taking all of this territory. But then they come in, and now the second time we come to it, we get Amraphel joining, and now it's four against five. Remember what they're doing. It says they seized all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah, and then they went away. All of your stuff is gone. All of your stuff is gone. And so let's just say you three guys can sit back down now, and you guys have taken all their goods, so you can sit back down now. And you guys, to do this, have come all the way over to Sodom. This is where Sodom is, and you've captured Lot. So I want to see you capture Lot. And I want you to take Lot over there. That was easy? All right, that's good right there. That's far enough. Now, Abram is about 20 miles away while all this is going on, and a messenger sees all of this happening. The messenger sees that Sodom has been overrun and all the possessions have been taken, and Lot, who was now living in Sodom. Think about it. Here's Abram and Lot. Abram says, go where you want to go. And he just goes kind of near Sodom. But now he's not only near Sodom, he is living in Sodom. And so the messenger sees it, and I think the next verse will say, verse 13, a man who had escaped came and reported this to Abram the Hebrew. So can you go, messenger, report that to Abram the Hebrew over there? Now, so messenger, you can be seated right there. Thank you. Abram has been a worshiper. He's been building altars everywhere. But now he's become a warrior because he knows that Lot is taken here. And so he is going to go rescue Lot. Now think about it. These other kings, by the way, who were the victorious kings? Oh, right here, the four. You know, you guys are like, you're taking it easy, right? You've won everything. You got Lot, right? So give me a pose that shows like you're taking it easy. All right. They're taking it easy. And so Abram goes to his 318 trained men. And this is like a stealth operation. All right. And they go back and they're going to rescue Lot. So you guys go and rescue Lot. All right. Take Lot over there. Lot is gone. In fact, it says, verse 15, during the night, Abram divided his men to attack them, and he routed them, pursuing them as far as Hobah, north of Damascus. He recovered all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possessions, together with the women and the other people. All right, so all you kings can sit down, except for Bera. Bera, if you'll come here. I'm sorry, she's Bera. And this new king, Melchizedek, two kings. So in the process of this, so now I would like the 318 men, they're done. Thank you for that. And Abram and Lot, you guys just start walking this direction and stop when you get up to these guys and shake their hands. So what happens after Lot is rescued by Abram, on the way back, they run into two kings, Bera and Melchizedek. In fact, that's verse 17. After Abram returned from defeating Chedorlaomer and the kings allied with him, the king of Sodom, that's Bera, came out to meet him in the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of the Most High God. Hey, there's something different about Melchizedek from all these other kings. He's not only a king, but he's also a priest. And what we're seeing is with these two right here, there are two very different approaches towards Abram. Melchizedek gives a spiritual approach, an approach of blessing. He brings out bread and wine. He's giving him some sustenance. And then the next verse goes on, it says, and the second thing he gives him is a blessing. I don't think Abram expected that to happen. It says he blessed Abram, saying, blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and praise be to God Most High who delivered your enemies into your hand. And then Abram gave him a tenth of everything. So Abram, you need to tithe to Bera. Not to Melchizedek. Oh, I'm sorry, to Melchizedek. You're right. That's right. I'm glad you gave it to the right king. So Bera is watching all this happen. Bera's watching Melchizedek give the food and receive the tithes. Now, remember, Abram and Lot, they've got possessions. They've got all the people that were in captivity. And they took some spoils from the city. And so Bera takes a totally different approach than Melchizedek does. Bera takes kind of like a business-like approach and wants to make a deal with Abram. Basically, you give me the people and I'll let you keep all the goods. All right? Are you following me? Abram now has the potential. All these goods that he captured. And this king, all the king wants is the people. You can keep all the goods, but look what Abram says to him in verse 22. I will accept nothing but what my men have eaten and the share that belongs to the men who went with me to Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them have their share. You know what Abram's doing there? He is declaring his total, absolute, 100% dependence on God and God alone. I'm not going to keep these spoiled. I'm not going to take anything from you, lest anybody think you're the one that's creating this to happen for me. So he's rejecting not only the offer from Bera, I think he possibly is rejecting Bera's viewpoint and perspective on things here. He believed that God would meet all of his needs. So I want to say thank you to all of you guys who helped. Let's give them a hand. You guys can return to your seats. Now, what is God doing in this story? There's no doubt that God is miraculously preserving Abram and blessing him in the way that he told him he was going to bless him back in Genesis chapter 12. There's no doubt that that's happened. God started a plan with Abram that he was going to bless all the nations through him and salvation was going to come through him. And the plan often looked like it was in danger. And yet in this case, God is miraculously making sure that Abram is still going to have this land and all that, in spite of all of these powerful kings and the wars and getting caught up in all of that. But God is also doing something else here. He's introducing us to a character named Melchizedek. Who is Melchizedek? Where did he come from? He seems like he's obscure. You know, think about it. When we teach our kids through the, you know, Sunday school, we tend to teach them about Moses and David and Abraham and Daniel, and we don't often teach him about Melchizedek. But Melchizedek is a very, very important figure in the Bible. This is the only Old Testament place where Melchizedek appears in a historical sense. He is alluded to, which we'll and talked about later, which we'll see in a minute. But this is all we have. This is all Melchizedek does. He comes to Abram, he receives tithes from Abram and he blesses Abram. And he's a king and he's a priest. And for this reason, because we don't know anything about him hardly, some people have said, well, maybe this is and Jesus is in the order of Melchizedek. Maybe this is a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus. In other words, pre-incarnate, before his incarnation, before Jesus was actually born in Jerusalem and lived, maybe he appeared, and this is one of those appearances. Well, some people have believed that, but the New Testament gives us no indication that Jesus had any ministry on earth before the incarnation, before he was born, and so I don't think that's a very convincing view. What do we know about Melchizedek? He was a king. He was a priest. His name means king of righteousness, or my king is righteous. He was a priest that lived in Canaan and he feared God. And that was unusual. The people in Canaan typically did not fear God, but he did. And yet he wasn't the only one. The Bible gives us many other people, many other non-Jews that somehow still feared God. They recognized that God was working in and through Israel. And after Genesis 14, we don't hear about Melchizedek until 1,000 years later. So now let's fast forward 1,000 years to Psalm 110. That's about that time was when King David was writing a psalm of praise to God. It was probably on the occasion, or it certainly surrounded his own ascendancy to the throne in Israel. The king in Israel was God's representative on earth for those people. And so David is coming to that throne. And yet, even as he's celebrating his own ascendancy to the throne, he starts speaking, or we probably singing, the Psalms were sung. He was singing about another king that was going to come, a king that would be a king and a priest. Psalm 110 verse 1, the Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. The Lord will extend your mighty scepter from Zion, saying, rule in the midst of your enemies. Your troops will be willing on your day of battle, arrayed in holy splendor. Your young men will come to you like dew from the morning's womb. There were three sacred offices in Israel, prophet, priest, and king, and they stayed separate from each other. David and his line took office of king, and that's what they were authorized to do, even though at times David does seemingly some priestly functions, but he was a king. But he looks out towards the distant future, and he sees another king that is going to come in his line, who's not going to be just a king. He's going to be a king and a priest, and a special type of priest. Verse 4, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever. We read out loud with me those last few words, in the order of Melchizedek. God was going to act in a new way. God was going to bring a priest king, like the priest king Melchizedek, who apparently was the king of Jerusalem. We'll find out later that he was the king of Salem. That was probably Jerusalem. David was predicting the Messiah. 1,000 years before Jesus ever was born, David predicted he was going to come, and he was going to come in this line. Now, let's fast forward another 1,000 years. So nearly 1,000 years after this, in the first century, Jesus indeed was born. And Jesus lived. And Jesus died. And he was buried. And he rose again. And while he was engaging, we're not going to turn there, but later you might want to look at Matthew 22. There's a time when the Jewish religious leaders were talking about the Messiah and who he might be. And Jesus asked him a tough question about David. Whose son is he? And is, if he's, you know, who is the Messiah? And he quotes Psalm 110 that points to himself. But he lives, he dies, he's buried, he rises again, and the New Testament starts getting born. The church is born. New Testament letters are written. Paul is writing different letters here and there, and others are writing New Testament letters. And one anonymous writer writes a letter to a group of Jewish Christians. All the early believers were Jewish. But one particular group, the Jewish Christians, the Hebrews, a long letter was written to them. And it's what we have in our Bible as the book of Hebrews. And it was, we don't know the exact date, but it was probably a little bit before 70 AD. The reason why I say that is in 70 AD, Titus, the Roman general, marched into Jerusalem, destroyed the temple. And so from that point on, there were no more sacrifices being offered. And the things that are written about in the book of Hebrews seem to come a little bit before that. So sometime in the 60s, probably, a letter was written. And before we read Hebrews chapter 7, I want to go back and read the first two verses that I read at the very outset this morning. I want to read them again to you. They speak of Jesus and the hope that he brings. Hebrews 6, 19 and 20. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. It enters in the inner sanctuary behind the curtain, where our forerunner Jesus has entered on our behalf. He has become a high priest forever, read it with me, in the order of Melchizedek. Wow. Now, Hebrews 7 is going to explain why that's important. And what does it mean that Jesus is a priest in the order of Melchizedek? So, beginning in verse 1, this Melchizedek was King of Salem and priest of God Most High. He met Abraham returning from the defeat of the kings and blessed him. And Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. First, the name Melchizedek means king of righteousness. Then also, king of Salem means king of peace. Jesus is greater than Melchizedek, of course. In fact, the whole argument about the book of Hebrews is how Jesus is greater than this person and this person and this person that they revered and set up in the Jewish faith. And yet, Jesus is a different kind of priest than the priest that came from Levite or the Levitical priest. Different type of priest, but he was in the order of Melchizedek, and yet he's also greater than Melchizedek. But there are some similarities here, and I want to point out three of these. I'm indebted to Kent Hughes, who helped me think this through about the three comparisons between Jesus as priest and Melchizedek as priest. Here we go. The first one is character. There are four aspects of Jesus' character that are like Melchizedek's. First of all, there is the priesthood. No Levitical priest could also be a king, but Jesus was. Jesus was both king and priest. Zechariah chapter 6, verse 13, foretold this about him. It said, he will be a priest on his throne. We often think of Jesus as a king, and he is king. But he was also a priest. Secondly, king. This Melchizedek was king of Salem. Revelation 19, 16 tells us what is going to be written on Christ's robe and thigh when he comes back, when he returns to the earth at the second coming. What is going to be written there is this phrase, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Another similarity is the righteousness. Melchizedek means, the very meaning of it is King of Righteousness. Isaiah chapter 9 that prophesies this coming Messiah says he will rule with righteousness. The New Testament identifies Jesus Christ, the righteous. And then finally, in their character, there is also peace. King of Salem means King of Peace. That same passage, Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, gives Jesus a title. He is the Prince of Peace. And Paul, the apostle in the New Testament, Ephesians chapter 2, says that he, speaking of Jesus, he himself is our peace. Verse 3, without father or mother, without genealogy, without beginning or days, beginning of days or end of life, resembling the Son of God, he remains a priest forever. That's talking about Melchizedek. He doesn't have father or mother, it says. He doesn't have a genealogy. He doesn't have a beginning of days or an end of life. And for some of those reasons, the way that language is, that's why people say, oh, well, maybe that was Christ in the Old Testament. But the next phrase says, resembling the Son of God. So it's not the Son of God. It's not a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. Melchizedek just resembled Jesus in all these factors. And this helps answer some questions about Melchizedek. Like, was he human or divine? It's figurative language here. It indicates that a human is in view. If Melchizedek in the Old Testament were actually Jesus, I think the language would be different. Now, how can the author say that Melchizedek didn't have a father or mother? Wait a minute. Doesn't everybody have a father and mother? Of course. So it's figurative language to show Genesis is a book of genealogies. We just don't have a record. In other words, Genesis does not record who Melchizedek's father was and who Melchizedek's mother was. That's all he's saying. There's no literal written record of it in the book of Genesis. And so what is true of Melchizedek figuratively is true of Jesus literally. The argument the writer of Hebrews is making here is that Melchizedek is greater than Abraham, and therefore Jesus is also greater than Abraham. So this without beginning, well, I'll call this qualifications. We've got character. The qualifications, the first one is there's no genealogy. In other words, if you were going to be a Levitical priest, you'd have the right genealogy. But here comes Melchizedek. We don't have any record of his genealogy. Why is Melchizedek a priest of God? Because God called him, period. Jesus doesn't have the bloodline genealogy of priests, but he was called by God. It's not based on heredity, but purely on the call of God. Secondly, there's no beginning or end without beginning of days or end of life. We know that Melchizedek had a beginning as a human being, but the Levitical priest could serve. They had term limits. 30 years was the most that a Levitical priest could serve. But there's silence about Melchizedek. How long did he serve? And the implication that the writer of Hebrews is pulling out here is he served in perpetuity. His life didn't end. It's not recorded. His birth isn't recorded. His death isn't recorded. And so he seems to be a permanent priest, and his priesthood seems to be a permanent priesthood. And we know Jesus did have a beginning of days humanly. We know he had an end of days humanly, but he rose again. He went back to heaven, and now he's serving in heaven as a priest forever and ever and ever. And so he continues to serve as a priest right now. Kent Hughes says, just as the sun does not exist for one moment without pouring out his light, so our Lord Jesus, our priest, cannot exist a single moment without interceding for his children. Verse 4, just think how great he was. Even the patriarch Abraham gave him a tenth of the plunder. Now, the law requires the descendants of Levi who become priests to collect a tenth from the people, that is, from their fellow Israelites, even though they also are descended from Abraham. So there's character, there's qualifications, and now there's superiority. Melchizedek is superior to the Levitical priest, and Jesus, as coming in his order, is also superior, and we see it in tithing. Abraham tithed to Melchizedek. In those days, when you tithed to someone, it showed that they were superior to you. The inferior person always tithed to the superior. Now remember, we don't have time to do the whole argument of the book of Hebrews, but Abraham was the man of faith, and the Jewish people put him on such a pedestal, and yet the writer's saying, wait a minute, Abraham tithed to Melchizedek, to the superior. It was a priestly action to receive tithes. That's what Melchizedek did. Abraham knew that he was in the presence of someone that was greater than himself. And the Levites, of course, collected tithes. And yet, they collected tithes based on the law. Everything we've been covering this morning in Genesis 14 happened before the law was even given. The law about tithing had not even been established yet. And yet, Abraham still tithes to Melchizedek. There's another way that Melchizedek, and hence Christ, is superior. That is verse 6. This man, however, did not trace his descent from Levi, yet he collected a tenth from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. And without doubt, the lesser is blessed by the greater. That is the blessing. Abraham had been told by God that in him all people were going to be blessed. In other words, Abram was going to become Abraham, and he was going to be the one through whom everybody got blessed. But now the tide has turned in Genesis 14, and Melchizedek is offering a blessing to Abraham. It shows his superiority. And the point of all of this, the point that the writer is building to here, is that just like Melchizedek was a superior priest to the Levites, they were from God. The Levitical priesthood was from God. They were good. There was nothing wrong with them. But Melchizedek was a different kind of priest. He was an eternal priest. He didn't have a beginning or an end. He didn't have a father or mother recorded. He was there as a priest because he was called by God. And Abraham tithed to him. And he blessed Abraham. Think how great this priest is. And Jesus is not a priest. It'd be great if Jesus was a priest. I mean, the priest served a very valuable function. But Jesus didn't come as a Levitical, in the order of the Levitical priest, but this one obscure figure that we only see in Genesis 14, that's the priesthood that Jesus' order follows. Does this make sense? This is heavy. This isn't lightweight. This isn't Bible 101 this morning. But we're going through Genesis 14. Look, let me just give you a couple more verses here out of Hebrews 7 to show you the amazing things about Jesus as a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Verse 15, what we have said is even more clear. If another priest like Melchizedek appears, one who has become a priest, not on the basis of a regulation as to his ancestry, but on the basis of the power of an indestructible life. For the law appoints as high priest men in all their weakness, but the oath, which was God's oath, which came after the law, appointed the Son, who has been made perfect forever. Remember I showed you this picture earlier? You've got the sign that shows you the Grand Canyon's coming. How many of you have seen that sign? This sign or one like it leading up to the Grand Canyon? It's kind of exciting when you get to that spot, right? How many of you have seen the Grand Canyon? Now, if you were going to choose to see the sign or see the Grand Canyon, which one would you choose? I got to go there. My middle son, when he was graduating from college, was taking a spring break trip out there, and his buddies bailed at the last minute. So, you know, nobody else to go, so he calls Dad. And we went, and it was awesome. Hiking down the Grand Canyon and looking around. That's a lot greater than this sign. Well, I think we would look at it this way. The sign is Melchizedek. we get this picture of this great priest. He's superior to all these other Old Testament priests, but he's only a sign. He's only pointing to someone greater. The reality, the Grand Canyon of priests is Jesus Christ. So here's God's word for us this morning. Christ is a priest like no other. Christ is a priest like no other, and in him we find what we need most. Christ is a priest like no other, and in him we find what we need most. You mentioned three things we find. We find salvation. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 26. Speaking of him, such a high priest truly meets our need. One who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. Unlike the other high priest, he does not need to offer sacrifices day after day, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. He sacrificed for their sins once for all when he offered himself. That's the greatness of our high priest Jesus. He didn't just sacrifice something that didn't really cost him anything. He sacrificed himself. He died on the cross to save you and me from our sins. And that is why he is superior. We find salvation in him. Is he your priest today? Do you just know about Jesus? Or do you have a personal relationship with him because you've believed in him and trusted him and taken him? Secondly, assurance. Just a couple of verses before that, beginning in verse 23. Now, there have been many of these priests, he's talking about the Levitical ones, since death prevented them from continuing in office, but because Jesus lives forever, he has a permanent priesthood. Therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him because he always lives to intercede for them. The key word here is forever. Jesus lives forever. All the priests along the way died because they were human. Jesus lives forever and he has a permanent priesthood, and that means he can save to the uttermost. He can save completely those who come to God through him, and that gives us assurance this morning. Do we really know we're saved? Is there security in our salvation? Will we lose our salvation somewhere if we have come to Jesus and we are trusting Jesus as our Lord and Savior? Is there a way to lose that? I would say this: our salvation is as dependable as long as Jesus is living. I think that's the way the author of Hebrews puts it. It's just as secure as Jesus' priesthood is secure because he's still living to make intercession. I'm glad I'm not making intercession for myself. I'm glad I'm not the one trying to convince God that I should be saved. Jesus is convincing God the Father, interceding on my behalf. Finally, righteousness and peace. Hebrews 7:2, the name Melchizedek means king of righteousness. And then also king of Salem means king of priests. I need a priest this morning. I'm a pastor, but I need a priest. I struggle with sin. I wrestle with damaging and destructive thoughts sometimes in my mind. I do really well some days and not so well on other days. I don't really want to stand before God's throne at the last day and have him look at me and evaluate me as if I have done enough to get into heaven based on my merits. Jesus is not only righteous, but he bestows righteousness on those that trust him. I need peace. He's the king of righteousness. He's the king of peace. Some days I'm at peace. Some days I experience the peace of God. And some days the difficulties and troubles and trials in life, I worry. I have a lack of peace. I need a high priest, don't you? Jesus is not only the Prince of Peace, but he's the one that gives us peace. He said, "My peace I leave with you. My peace I give you. I do not give you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled and do not be afraid." Do you need this kind of priest this morning? I have good news for you. This is the good news of the gospel. He's there for you today. In fact, the good news of the gospel is that Christ is a priest like no other. And in him, we find all we need. This week, as I was studying, the lyrics to a song came to my mind, and I hadn't looked at the planning sheet. I didn't know what was going to be sung this morning. And as I Googled the lyrics, because I knew some of them, but I wanted to read the whole thing, and it was, "Before the throne of God I stand." And then I found out that Chad and the worship team were already planning to use that song today. Thank you, Chad, for picking great biblical songs to help us worship. Not just songs we like to sing, but great truths. Before the throne of God above, I have a strong and perfect plea. A great high priest whose name is love, whoever lives and pleads for me. My name is graven in his hands. My name is written on his heart. I know that while in heaven he stands, no tongue can bid me thence depart. Let's stand together with our heads bowed.
Thanks again for joining us today from Harvest Community Church. This podcast is also available on our website, harvestcharlotte.com. Please go there if you want to send a question or comment, learn more about our ministries, or find out about how you can donate to support the podcast.